for having that again today.
Professor Nelson Lichtenstein, I want to thank you for being with us at the University of California, Santa Barbara. We will also link to your books, State of the Union. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. Stay safe. Wear a mask.
Listening to KBOO Portland 90.7 FM, listener-supported community radio.
KBOO Community Radio is listener-sponsored. That's right, 80% of our funding comes from donations from listeners just like you. You can always make a donation to help keep KBOO independent and non-commercial at kboo.fm/give. But right now, during our end-of-year drive, it's the perfect time to contribute. Give now and help us reach our goal of $45,000 by December 31st, and your donation will be matched, dollar for dollar, up to $10,000, thanks to the generous support of the Ronnie S. LaCroute Fund for the Oregon Community Foundation. Double the impact of your tax-deductible year-end donation at kboo.fm/give today.
KBOO Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KBOO in accordance with requirements of the Communications Act of 1934 and certification requirements of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Information about KBOO Community Radio's open meeting policy is available at our website at kboo.fm. Due to temporary closure of in-station activity at KBOO, meetings will be conducted online via public video conferencing unless otherwise noted. A public link and phone number to attend the meetings are available at our website. The Personnel Committee meets on the second Monday of the month at 6 p.m. Please visit our website at kboo.fm to verify if a meeting is being held.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on this end-of-year membership drive special of the KBOO Evening News. Oregon's first Omicron variant cases are found in Multnomah and Washington counties. The Oregon legislature approves $400 million in rental assistance, eviction protections, and other emergency funding. And U.S. cybersecurity officials warn a new software flaw leaves millions of computers vulnerable. Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Tuesday, December 14th, 2021. KBOO is currently in our end-of-year membership drive, and we'd like to urge you to become a member by going online to kboo.fm/give. I'm Yasmin Kobanoglu. The Oregon Health Authority announced on Monday that three cases of the COVID-19 Omicron variant have been detected in Oregon. The three cases were found in Multnomah and Washington counties. Health officials have said since Omicron was first detected in the U.S. that it was only a matter of time until the variant would make it to Oregon. State epidemiologist Dr. Dean Seidlinger said, quote, "We recognize this news is concerning to many people. However, if history is our guide, we do know that even if a vaccine doesn't target a specific variant, the strong immune response you get from being fully vaccinated can still be highly protective against severe disease from all COVID-19 variants," end quote. Seidlinger said OHA and its lab partners will continue to monitor how Omicron spreads through Oregon. The Omicron variant has also been detected in Washington State, in Thurston, Pierce, and King counties. So far, Omicron has been found in more than 30 states. National health officials are still studying the effects of the variant to determine the severity of its symptoms and are continuing to urge people to get vaccinated and get their boosters. Additional data from Pfizer's clinical trial of its oral COVID-19 antiviral drug has confirmed the treatment's high level of effectiveness. The company said in a news release on Tuesday that its antiviral drug, called Paxlovid, was found to be 89% effective at preventing high-risk people from being hospitalized or dying from COVID-19. The findings are consistent with data the company released last month, although the full results have not been made public for scientists to review. Pfizer has submitted an application to the Food and Drug Administration for emergency use authorization. The FDA has not yet scheduled a meeting of its advisory committee to review the drug. Experts say an antiviral pill for COVID would have a major impact on the pandemic by making treatment available at home. Current treatments are available only by injection or IV. A full course of Pfizer's treatment is three pills taken twice daily for 5 days. It was shown to work best when given within 3 days of the onset of symptoms. The Biden administration said last month it plans to purchase 10 million courses of Paxlovid. The FDA's advisory committee also voted narrowly last month to recommend a different antiviral from drug maker Merck for emergency use authorization. Merck's drug, called molnupiravir, has yet to be authorized by the FDA. In a special session on Monday, the Oregon legislature approved $400 million in spending to address rent assistance, eviction protections, and other emergencies. Large investments from Monday's vote include $100 million to replenish the state's rent assistance program and another $100 million to create a statewide system of more localized eviction prevention services. Lawmakers also extended eviction protections for renters awaiting rental aid from the state in an effort to prevent more than 10,000 Oregon households on the brink of eviction from losing their homes. They will have until June of 2022 to apply for protection, which would expire in September of 2022 at the latest. Other topics the legislature took action on Monday include allocating $100 million to help farmers and ranchers hurt by this year's drought and unprecedented heat wave, as well as $25 million to combat water theft and violence caused by illegal marijuana grow operations in southern Oregon. The cannabis bill also contains protections for exploited migrant workers. Lawmakers directed $18 million to Afghan refugee resettlement services and $2 million for gun violence reduction in East Multnomah County. Toward the end of Monday's special legislative session, Republican Senator Dallas Hurd of Roseburg, chair of the Oregon Republican Party, was escorted off the Senate floor for refusing to put on a mask. Oregon's indoor mask mandate and Senate rules require anyone in the chamber to wear a mask. Portland City Commissioner Joanne Hardesty filed a $5 million lawsuit on Monday against the City of Portland, the city's police union, its former president, and a Portland Police Bureau officer. The lawsuit alleges they leaked information that falsely implicated Hardesty in a hit-and-run crash last spring. The lawsuit, filed in Multnomah County Circuit Court, names the Portland Police Association, its former president Brian Hunziker, a PPB officer named Carrie Ottoman, as well as the City of Portland. Hardesty is seeking $3 million in damages from the police union, $1 million from Hunziker, $1 million from Ottoman, and just $1 from the City of Portland. Hardesty's attorneys issued a statement saying, quote, "Commissioner Hardesty's advocacy for true police accountability and reform makes her public enemy number one for many at the PPB and PPA. Yet, despite attempts to punish her for her advocacy and force her out of office in retribution for her tirelessness and effective advocacy, Commissioner Hardesty will not be silenced." End quote. On March 3rd of this year, a woman called 911 to report that her car had been rear-ended hours earlier and that she was starstruck because she recognized the driver of the other vehicle as Hardesty. That claim was incorrect. Less than 24 hours after the 911 call, Portland police determined the actual suspect was a Vancouver, Washington woman, not Hardesty. But in that time, the rumor had spread to multiple right-wing media outlets as well as the Oregonian, all of whom published the allegation. Hardesty is the first Black woman elected to the Portland City Council. She is also one of Oregon's most outspoken critics of law enforcement. For those reasons, the lawsuit alleges the named officers and the police union were motivated to leak damaging information about Hardesty. The lawsuit accuses both Ottoman and Hunziker of aiding and abetting in the city's discrimination against Hardesty, as well as intentional interference of economic relations, false light, and public disclosure of private facts. Most of the lawsuit is focused on the leak and how it damaged Hardesty, but her attorneys also argue that the police investigation of the hit-and-run itself showed discrimination. In addition to the $1 in monetary damages that Hardesty is seeking from the city, she is also asking for a declaration stating the city violated her rights to be free from racially based discrimination and retaliation under Oregon's public accommodations laws. As advocates urge the Biden administration to extend the pause on student loan repayments and honor a pledge to cancel $10,000 in loan debts, some are finding success with the administration's focus on pre-existing loan forgiveness programs. Tramell Gomes has more on the story.
As more than 200 organizations call on the Biden administration to extend the pause on student loan repayments, some borrowers are finding success through the Public Service Loan Forgiveness Program. The Biden administration's approach to student loan relief so far has been on improving or expanding a handful of programs that already were on the books, even as advocates press for the campaign promise of canceling $10,000 in student debt per person. Susan Garcia is a professor of music at Miami-Dade College, who says she was able to see her loans forgiven in the modified program for educators, nurses, and public employees who give 10 years of service.
It is $92,000 of payments that have been forgiven. And for me, that is like incredible because I'm 58 years old. I'm headed toward retirement. I have a 17-year-old son who's looking to go to college and trying to figure out how he's going to do that.
Garcia is encouraging others to take advantage of the now streamlined program, which according to the Education Department, already has forgiven $2 billion in debt. The pandemic moratorium on federal student loans is set to expire after January 31st. Garcia says the student debt crisis is real. She credits organizations such as the American Federation of Teachers for pushing for reform to make it possible for her loans to be forgiven, which started out at around $120,000.
Don't get me wrong. It wasn't like I didn't make payments for the last. I've paid over $148,000, mostly interest only, since I separated from school.
One major change to the Public Service Loan Forgiveness Program allows all payments by student borrowers to count, regardless of loan program or payment plan. That waiver runs through October of next year. However, a survey by the Student Debt Crisis Center found that 89% of fully employed student loan borrowers said they were not financially secure enough to resume loan payments on February 1st. This is Tramell Gomes.
The top U.S. cybersecurity agency is warning that a new, easy-to-exploit software vulnerability has likely led to hundreds of millions of computer hacks around the world. The flaw is in Log4j, a snippet of open-source code widely used in internet applications to help track users' activity. Since it's used in so many applications and most modern organizations' computer networks rely on multiple different programs, there are scores of opportunities to exploit that flaw. Director of the Cybersecurity and Infrastructure Agency, Jen Easterly, said it is likely that many computer systems have already been compromised. While the vulnerability is unlikely to threaten the security of people's personal devices, it could be used to gain a foothold to hack practically any organization online that does not update the software. Cybersecurity professionals around the world have scrambled in the past few days to fix the issue after it was discovered on Thursday. Hackers were using the flaw to trick victims into mining small amounts of cryptocurrency and to hack private Minecraft servers. So far, there are not many public reports of crippling hacks stemming from the vulnerability. Still, security professionals spent much of the weekend trying to fix every potential place it could be exploited. Fraud experts are offering tips to protect yourself from scammers during the holiday season. They say if an online deal sounds too good to be true, it probably is. Eric Tegedoff has more on the story.
People are out and about shopping for the holidays. Unfortunately, scammers are looking to take advantage of their good cheer. Carmel Snyder with AARP Oregon says the season offers plenty of opportunities for thieves.
The point isn't to take the joy out of this time of year when we're talking about it or the fun out of gift giving, but to help you be aware so you can protect yourself and your loved ones.
According to a new AARP survey, more than a third of American adults have experienced fraud when buying a product through an online ad. Snyder says it's best to steer clear of these ads altogether when shopping online.
Avoid clicking on links, even if you think the message or ad is from a familiar retailer. Instead, use your web browser and type the web address you know to be the right one to avoid getting sent to a cloned site.
Snyder says scammers use cloned sites that look like legitimate sites to steal people's information. Package deliveries also are ripe for theft and fraud. The AARP survey finds a quarter of people responding have had a package stolen from outside their home, and more than a third have received a fake notification about a shipment. Snyder says don't respond to these messages, and be on the lookout for red flags that make the message sound urgent. Scammers try to pressure people to act quickly before they have time to think about what they're doing. Snyder also says people shouldn't be embarrassed to report scams because they could be helping someone else.
These are professionals. They do this all the time. They're very sophisticated and they're good at what they do. They steal billions of dollars from Americans every year.
Snyder hosts Watchdog Wednesday, a webinar where experts share tips on how to avoid scams. She says the event will become a podcast in 2022. I'm Eric Tegedoff reporting.
You're listening to an end-of-year membership drive special of the KBOO Evening News. Our goal is to raise $45,000 by December 31st. We'd like to remind you that you can renew your KBOO membership or become a member at any time during this program by going online to kboo.fm/give. Stay tuned after this newscast for Coast Range Radio. Then at 6, it's Preference. And at 7, Hard Knock Radio. Tonight's weather will be rainy with a low of 39 degrees. Tomorrow will again be rainy with a high of 41 degrees. Today in history, in 2012, the Sandy Hook Elementary School shooting occurs in Newtown, Connecticut. 20 first graders and 6 school employees were killed, making it, at the time, the second deadliest mass shooting in the U.S. after the 2007 shooting at Virginia Tech. In the aftermath of the Sandy Hook shooting, President Barack Obama called for new gun safety measures. However, his primary legislative goal, expanding background checks for gun buyers, was blocked by the Senate. The Sandy Hook Elementary School shooting is now the fourth deadliest mass shooting in the U.S., following the Orlando nightclub shooting in 2016 and the Las Vegas shooting in 2017. The quote of the day is from American politician, lawyer, and author Barack Obama, who served as the 44th president of the United States. Obama said, quote, "For too long, we've been blind to the unique mayhem that gun violence inflicts upon this nation. Sporadically, our eyes are open. When 8 of our brothers and sisters are cut down in a church basement, 12 in a movie theater, 26 in an elementary school. But I hope we also see the precious lives cut short by gun violence in this country every single day. The countless more whose lives are forever changed." The District of Columbia Attorney General announced Tuesday that he is suing more than 24 members of the Proud Boys and Oath Keepers in an effort to recover costs related to the U.S. Capitol attack on January 6th. The lawsuit, filed in federal court in Washington, D.C., accuses 31 members of the extremist groups of, quote, "a coordinated act of domestic terrorism," end quote. The lawsuit details how members of the Oath Keepers and Proud Boys allegedly devised a plan for violence on January 6th. The lawsuit accuses the group's leaders of recruiting members to travel to the Capitol, plus accuses them of conducting training and providing weapons and tactical gear. D.C. Attorney General Carl Racine is asking the court to find the extremists liable for the millions of dollars officials spent dispatching officers to the Capitol, along with the enormous expense of treating the injured officers and paying for their medical leave in the months after the attack. Three officers from the Capitol Police and Metropolitan Police Departments died in the days after the attack, and more than 140 officers were injured. This is not the first civil lawsuit filed against members of the extremist groups who stormed the Capitol on January 6th. Several members of Congress have sued leaders of the two organizations, in addition to former President Donald Trump and his former attorney Rudy Giuliani, for conspiring to incite the insurrection. Seven Capitol Police officers have also filed a similar lawsuit against the former president and leaders of the extremist groups for their roles on January 6th. The Justice Department has already charged several members of the Oath Keepers with federal criminal conspiracy. Prosecutors have been building their case for months, releasing details of how the group allegedly gathered and stashed weapons at a Northern Virginia Comfort Inn as part of their so-called quick reaction force, and how they communicated during the insurrection. The court filings against members of the group also detail how most of the Oath Keeper defendants are accused of taking part in a military-like formation called a stack to cut through the crowd to enter the Capitol. President Joe Biden will visit tornado-ravaged Kentucky. Senator Joe Manchin continues to push back on the Build Back Better bill. And former Trump administration official Mark Meadows is referred for criminal contempt charges. With more on the story, it's Mary Sherman with 2021 Talks.
Welcome to 2021 Talks, where we're following our democracy in historic times.
In this time of crisis, Kentuckians are standing shoulder to shoulder, and we will not fail.
Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell said the tornadoes that ravaged his home state are the worst he's ever seen, and thanked President Joe Biden for approving a disaster declaration. At least 80 people were killed in storms across six states. Biden will survey the damage in Kentucky Wednesday. Illinois Governor J.B. Pritzker says an investigation is underway into the deadly roof collapse at an Amazon warehouse.
Six individuals clocked in on Friday, and they never came home. An additional person is still receiving medical treatment.
President Biden spoke again with Joe Manchin Monday, trying to convince the West Virginia Democrat to vote for his Build Back Better Act. Manchin wants to put the brakes on negotiations to fully examine the economic environment.
Inflation is real. It's not transitory. It's alarming. It's going up, not down. And I think that should be something we're concerned about.
Senate leaders want to pass the bill by the end of the year, but need all 50 Democrats on board to use the reconciliation process. Biden signed an executive order to improve dozens of government services, including airport screening and passport renewals, and a new federal online system to make it easier to interact with the government. Vice President Kamala Harris announced a new administration plan to build 500,000 electric charging stations across the U.S.
In this imperative to go electric, there is an immense opportunity. We will create good paying, good union jobs in communities around our country.
The new infrastructure law sets aside $5 billion for states to build the network. The January 6th committee voted to refer Mark Meadows for a charge of criminal contempt of Congress. The former Trump White House chief of staff initially cooperated by providing thousands of documents, which Chair Benny Thompson said raised questions.
When it's time for him to follow the law, come in and testify on those questions. He changed his mind and told us to pound sand. He didn't even show up.
Through an attorney, Meadows said the referral decision was unwise, unfair, and contrary to law. The Supreme Court is refusing to block New York's vaccine mandate for healthcare workers, which allows medical but not religious exemptions. And the Air Force has discharged more than two dozen people for refusing to get the COVID-19 vaccine, the first service members believed to be removed for disobeying the mandate. Meanwhile, protests against COVID restrictions in Germany turned violent. At least a dozen police officers were injured over the weekend, and several journalists were attacked. With the threat of the Omicron variant, Germany is tightening restrictions, starting child vaccinations, and considering a general vaccine mandate. I'm Mary Sherman for Pacifica Network and Public News Service. Find our 8 trust indicators to support transparency and accuracy at publicnewsservice.org.
Oklahoma Governor Kevin Stitt upends tribal hunting and fishing compacts, patients and staff at a New Mexico hospital with a predominantly Native patient base express concerns over what they say is declining levels of service, and the NDN Collective is awarded a $50 million grant from the Bush Foundation. With that story and more, it's Art Hughes with National Native News.
This is National Native News. I'm Art Hughes, in for Antonio Gonzalez. The governor of Oklahoma says he will not renew long-standing hunting and fishing compacts with the Cherokee and Choctaw Nations. In response, the tribes say they will expand hunting rights for their citizens and eliminate the requirement for state licenses. KFOR-TV reports the compacts have been in place since 2016 and provide a steep license discount for tribal members. In exchange, the news outlet reports the tribes pay a combined $38 million a year to the state. Cherokee Principal Chief Chuck Hoskins calls the decision by Governor Kevin Stitt tremendously disappointing. Hoskins says it's an attack on tribal sovereignty and is in keeping with Stitt's efforts to undermine collaboration between tribes and the state. The Oklahoman reports leaders from both Cherokee and Choctaw say they will expand hunting and fishing to a larger area of tribal trust land and tribally owned land starting January 1st for all tribal citizens with no need for a state license. Community members in Gallup, New Mexico, say they are worried about the future of medical services at Rehoboth McKinley County Hospital. A majority of the patients at RMCH are Native. KGLP's Rachel Cobb reports.
Community members gathered to share their concerns about a nonprofit hospital in Gallup, New Mexico. At RMCH, about 70% of patients are Native. Among the problems endangering hospital services are a lack of trust in hospital administration, a low quality rating, a $9.4 million deficit, and staff leaving.
I'm Caleb Lauber, and I was terminated from RMCH, the only Navajo-speaking physician there. I had a number of Navajo-speaking patients that no longer had a physician. This is not lost, I want you to know. We have to become a collective group of individuals and speak out.
More staff have left voluntarily.
My name is Beatrice Nunez. I have been at Red Rock Clinic for the last year in the OBGYN department. My vacancy has not been filled. Procedures that can only be provided by an RN will have to be provided in the labor and delivery department. At this time, there are only four available rooms, so it is probable that patients will have to travel to other hospitals for their procedures that can be easily and efficiently provided in the clinic.
Patients plus present and former RMCH staff are encouraged to share their concerns with McKinley County management since the county owns the hospital building. For National Native News, this is Rachel Cobb in Gallup, New Mexico.
Nevada officials are promising support and commitment to uncover the full truth about boarding schools in that state. The Nevada Independent reports Governor Steve Sisolak offered a formal apology to tribes for what he calls an abhorrent policy that resulted in long-lasting trauma. He says elected leaders need to make amends. The comments came after Sisolak met with tribal representatives at the former Stewart Indian School in Carson City that saw some 20,000 Native students during its 90 years in operation. The records from that time are in the hands of federal officials. The building is now a museum and a law enforcement academy. The governor promised to aid the investigations into boarding schools demanded by Interior Secretary Deborah Holland. Sisolak says the investigation involves searching for and identifying any human remains on the campus. The Minnesota-based Bush Foundation is awarding a $50 million grant to the NDN Collective. The foundation issued a statement saying the collective has the trust and respect of the communities they serve. Collective President and CEO Nick Tilson issued a statement saying the grant is an opportunity to begin to indigenize and redefine the meaning of wealth. The organization says it will start a comprehensive planning and design process next month that will take input from community partners. They say they intend to begin redistributing the money through grants by late 2022. With National Native News, I'm Art Hughes.
You're listening to an end-of-year membership drive special of the KBOO Evening News. Call or text us with your breaking news stories and tips at 971-245-2158. The producer for tonight's newscast is Yasmin Kobanoglu, and our engineer is Otto. Special thanks to Tramel Gomes, Art Hughes, Mary Sherman, and Eric Tegadoff. Our evening news director is Althea Billings. A podcast of this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/evening news. You're listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. I'm Yasmin Kobanoglu. Coming up tomorrow morning on KBOO. At 8, it's Wednesday Talk Radio. Host Paul Roland is joined by Richard Heinberg, senior fellow at the Post-Carbon Institute and author of new book, Power, Limits and Prospects for Human Survival. At 9, it's Fight the Empire. Host Per Fagerang connects history with the latest world events. At 10, it's Flashpoints, investigative news radio with host Dennis Bernstein. Then at 11, it's The Food Show. Host Emily Becker keeps you on top of the news and issues surrounding the food on your plate. All of these KBOO programs are made possible by support from our members. KBOO is currently in our end-of-year fundraising drive, and our goal is to raise $45,000 by December 31st. If you'd like to become a member and support our programming, you can go to kboo.fm/give or text KBOO to 44321. Stay tuned now for Coast Range Radio.
Hey y'all, thanks for tuning in to Coast Range Radio, a radio program of the Coast Range Association. My name is Andrew. Send us an email. We want to hear from our listeners. Ask us some questions. Let us know what you think of the show. You can reach me at andrew@coastrange.org. We want to hear from you. Today, our interviewee is a human rights campaigner and policy advocate who supports nonprofits, coalitions, and communities fighting injustice. Currently, he is a senior policy advisor with Oxfam. Previously, he has held roles with Democracy International